Right, well, good morning, everyone. I'm not going to keep you long because Tim's going to make a more formal welcome and introduction. I just thought we'd just reflect this morning as we sit in this amazing lecture theatre with this lovely kit, how far we've come in the last 5 years. And I say we quite deliberately because I learned a long time ago that just me running around and waving my arms doesn't achieve much. But getting the community together and talking to you all and engaging with you all and really understanding what our hopes and dreams and ambitions for this place are does make change happen. And this lecture theatre and the others around, the learning technology that we have here at the moment and the speed at which we embrace learning technology really shows where we are. You know, my ambition for the place is to put us at the top of the learning and teaching league tables, to drop anchor there, and then to load our cannon and repel all borders, okay? And that's what this conference is all about. So without much further ado, I'll pass you over to a much more considered welcome and introduction. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks. I'm not sure about the considered element, but this is our fifth annual Learning and Teaching Conference, ORTEL. Should actually be ORLET, I think, but I've taken that up with Mary and she still wants to stick with ORTEL. Nevertheless, I usually take this opportunity to reflect on the image associated with the conference. This year we have what looks like a tree of knowledge of learning and teaching. Not quite sure what the trolley cart is there for, but presumably that's because it is partly involved in purchasing, at least from the students' experience. We have about 100 attendees signed up this year. We were hoping to break the 100 mark. I think we probably have broken the 100 mark, which is great news. And actually, there are more people who usually come along who don't sign up formally as well. But we also have a number of others here whom I'd like to welcome. Colleagues from College Cambria who are here as part of their PGC-THE, and very particular welcome to them. We have someone from JISC who's not here at the moment, but I think is coming along later in the conference and involves herself in the live blogging of the conference, as has happened on previous occasions. And we also have a return of old friends, if you like, Kerr Gardner sitting up at the back there, who now works for Turnitin, but worked with us in the past on the Gwekler project, which was our first big e-learning initiative back, when was it, about 7-8 years ago now, I guess. We're pleased to have you back, Kerr. who works now after Glasgow, he now works for Turnitin. So any of you who've got issues, he's in the purple shirt at the back there. We've seen in this last year the emergence of the TEF, the first iteration of the TEF, and that, of course, the results which came out, 2-3 weeks ago, that's placed a more acute stress on learning and teaching in higher education, if you didn't already know that stress was there. In addition to that, you'll have read the report this year again, after last year, from the BBC, that students increasingly feel that their fees are not good value for money. Now, there are issues attached to that report, and I don't want to go into the details, but that's the sort of context in which we're working. And it places us under increasingly significant responsibility to ensure that we keep ourselves up to date with new teaching developments and new debates within teaching. And our own module evaluation questionnaire process, which has run over the last year, shows me that we can't be complacent about our teaching practices or meeting student expectations and keeping classes fresh. We do have to keep upskilling ourselves. Not a word I like to use, but that's in effect what we're doing. And keeping abreast of various debates within teaching and learning practice. And so we've got this conference, which comes around once a year. It felt like it was only a couple of months ago, actually, the last one. But it comes around once a year, and it's there to aid us in our learning. And we've got papers this year on embedding innovative assessment practices, engaging with all sorts of technologies, from Blackboard to 3D vision goggles. There'll be a paper on Wednesday morning and a demonstration, I hope. And there are also there will also be the introduction of a whole new pedagogical practice, and we've got the Pro Vice Chancellor from York University coming to talk to us about the York pedagogy tomorrow afternoon. And we've got Lego-inspired teaching, which is terrific, really, because we had a talk, if you remember, at a conference 2 years ago, about Lego teaching and the element of play in teaching, and we already have instances where those sorts of talks have borne fruit. And so this conference, I think, does play a significant role within our continuing professional development in learning and teaching amongst the community at Aberystwyth. And to that end, I think I'd like to pay particular thanks to John for his continual involvement and resourcing of the conference. And we are very grateful to him for being involved in all aspects in that respect. There's Kate Wright and the e-learning team, Sue upstairs. I've probably forgotten others, but you know, those people who work behind the scenes, often with the teaching and learning enhancement projects around the university, and fixing our problems with Panopto and Turnitin and Blackboard and so on. And thanks to you, and of course, not least, Mary Jacob. Who is the key organizer of the conference and principal enthusiast. She has been driving everything, and I'd like to pay thanks to you in particular, Mary. And on that note, I hope that you all have an engaged 2.5 days, what is it, about that long, and that you feel that you will get something out of it and that it helps with your teaching practice in the forthcoming year. And in that, I'll hand over to Mary to get us going.
I'm just going to make sure this is all properly on. Oh, yes, that's better. Thank you very much for those wonderful introductions. And before Kate and I are going to be talking about a little project, or rather large project, actually, that we've run over the past year and just rolling out, coming up. There'll be a big reveal in the next few days, I think. But before I do that, I would like to tell a very short story and thank a couple of people as well. First off, so that I need to thank Jesse. Is Jesse in here? Yes. Jesse is the Aberforward graduate assistant who's been helping with the conference, and you've done a great job. And I'd like to thank Kate and the whole e-learning group, who, it's really a team effort, it's not something one person can do. But in particular, I have thanks for the two people who've just spoken. More than 5 years ago, John Grattan, who had just come into position as Pro Vice Chancellor, and you burst into the e-learning group's office, and we had a different team leader at that time, Shelley Upton. Many of you might remember Shelley. And you said, "I want you to run a conference." And we said, "Yes." And you supported us all the way through for 5 year after year. And sometimes we twist your arm and ask for a little bit more money. Maybe I shouldn't say it like that. But the support and the inspiration that you have given, and I don't know whether it's always that obvious to the university community, has been absolutely amazing. So we have a little card to thank you.
Thank you very much.
And then for this year, while John was acting Vice Chancellor, and Tim, you have also played a big role with our e-learning group all along, and between you and John have both been the big support with chairing TEL and working with some of our projects at Wetla and the benchmarking and everything. But you've been amazing on the conference this year, and so I want to thank you as well. So this is a little something from our experience. So it's the fifth annual conference, and we're absolutely delighted to have everybody here. And we think that next year, possibly, we might open it up to the public and have a conference fee and welcome, you know, have it bigger and better. And so watch this space. So I'm going to say just a few things, and then I'll turn over to Kate. I just want to share with you a project that we ran called Students on Tech. This was a Learning and Teaching Enhancement Fund supported project, and it involved a team of students working with me to run student focus groups and student survey and also video blogs. We had two aims with this project. First of all, a show of hands, how many of you think our homepage was too busy on Blackboard? Yes, okay, we knew we had to do something, but what? Everybody wanted the stuff in there that's in there. Somebody wanted it in there. So how do we know what the students want? So we needed to find that out. We also wanted to help staff and students understand each other. So we ran, and I'm not going to go into this live now, but you can see the link, you can scan the QR code if you want to go to the video blog. We thought it would be useful for students to blog about their use of technology to enhance their own learning and anything good that their teachers are doing. So it's all appreciative inquiry, you know, good practice type stuff. So that's a screenshot of the blog showing a post. This was mainly, we were fully staffed up by January, and it ran through semester two. We were hoping to run it for a longer period of time, but, and there is a video clip, which again, I think I won't take the time to play for you now. Maybe I'll play it, okay. I haven't checked the sound on this machine this morning because we've been running around doing other things. Let's see how this is working. No. Sorry. Let's see. On this, I didn't have a chance to check the sound. Hey, can you help with that? Maybe I do that. Let's see. Let's try that. That might be enough. No. You're not going to hear them speak if we don't have them. It's not muted over here. And it's not muted there. No.
Better.
Sorry, we were quite busy with setting up other things for the conference. We don't have the sound turned on in here. We will sort that out later. But I'm not going to worry about that right now. But basically, we had four student assistants. They worked for a period of about 5 to 6 months. They ran student focus groups and an online survey, and I think we got just up to statistically significant number of responses, well over 300 responses from our students. They wrote recommendations for the refresh of Blackboard, which is currently underway. It's not fully rolled out, but I think you're going to be really excited about what we see. And they did the video blog and social media. So they were all over the place with Twitter and Facebook and some of our tweets, especially when people like Pro Vice Chancellors retweet them. Thank you again for your support. People like that have had quite a large impact. So this is an intermediate stage. I'm not going to worry about this one at the moment. To be honest, it's sort of, I think that's about what I have to say. We have, if you go onto the blog, you can find more information. You can play the video. That's on the university-hosted WordPress site, so it's on wordpress.eber, and students on tech, you can see it in there. But I think you will be excited with what we have to offer. Now I'm going to turn over to Kate for the redesign.
So running parallel to the work that we did with students was some work that we did with staff. So the students organised and ran focus groups themselves, and we got an awful lot of information from surveys as well. So running alongside that, we also wanted to get the opinions of staff. And we took the approach of using a change management technique called appreciative inquiry. Now, it's been quite widely used in industry. It's been around since the 1980s, primarily in industry. But as time has gone on, there's been more interest growing of the use of appreciative inquiry in higher education. And the particular approach that appreciative inquiry takes is that it doesn't start with what's wrong with something. So it doesn't start with what's wrong with the system or what's wrong with the policy or approach. And then move on to how to fix it. Primarily because that tends to lead to a mindset of problem solving and can lead to a defensive mindset. People think, well, is it really that wrong? Why do we need to fix it? Appreciative inquiry starts from taking the best thing about something. So it says, what's your best experience? What's your best part of this system? It might be a small thing, it might be a big thing, but what's the best thing and how can we build on and how can we develop that? And it uses a lot of storytelling. It asks people to tell their stories about using those systems, about using those processes and procedures, and says, how can we make that best thing even better? How can we extend that best thing? So we introduced appreciative inquiry this time last year. We ran some sessions on that. And then we ran over semester two some hands-on workshops with staff. So these were just for our staff, and as I say, the students organised the student sessions themselves. The main messages, unsurprisingly, we got back from staff and students were pretty much the same. They were very, very similar, and it was quite easy then to work with that. If we'd got different opinions from the students and the staff, it would have been quite difficult to mould the two. But unsurprisingly, and I imagine as I say the kind of things that we found out, you're probably going to nod along and go, yeah, we think that. So the main messages from both sides, from both staff and students, were the main purpose of using Blackboard is for learning and teaching. We're not going there to get lots of other things. We're not going there to pick up our news. We're not going there to find lots of things. We're going there because we want to get to our modules and we want to get to them as quickly as possible. I think my favourite thing that I got out of the staff session was someone said, oh no, I never look at that stuff on Blackboard. If it's important, you'll email me. Okay, there we go. So that's something we learned. Simplicity. We heard a lot about simplicity, about stripping stuff back, about getting rid of a lot of stuff. Simplicity was the key. Another thing that came, and I think this reflects trends generally in web design, is around flexibility, around personalisation, about being able to make the system do the things that you want to do, to display in the ways that you want it to display. We haven't been able to do everything people asked for, but we've been able to do quite a lot. We have a fantastic systems designer, and he's done some amazing things for us, which we hope when we launch these, you'll look at them and think, oh, why didn't we have this a long time ago? Some of them are little tweaks, so things like you wanted to be able to control how you viewed the module ID code in Blackboard. Some people wanted to see it, some people didn't want to see it. We've given you the flexibility to do that. Colour coding, we've given some abilities to change colour coding. As Mary said, it's not quite ready. We've had a few other things that we've been doing over the last few weeks, something about a conference that we've been organising. It will be coming very soon, but just to give you a sneak preview of what it's going to look like. So, and you'll recognise this. This is probably what you see every day. And we've actually had this for 5 years. Blackboard has looked like this for 5 years. At a time when the university website was very yellow and it was very purple, and we went with the very yellow and very purple. So this is what we're going to have next within the next few weeks. Much simpler design. We've stripped a lot of those boxes away. And a lot more targeted information. So you may see something because you're a particular person or you have a particular role in the university, and somebody else might not. It will be a single landing page for all users. There won't be a stats tab, there won't be a student tab. It will be a single page, and my modules will be there, front and centre, big box. You'll see your modules. About 5 years ago, we decided we might brand Blackboard. We'd go for an Aberystwyth approach to Blackboard, and we use Aberlearn Blackboard. It's never really landed, if we're honest, so we're just going to call it Blackboard because that's what everybody else calls it. Instead of those purple boxes advertising news, we'll have a scrolling banner, a little bit like you have on the university website, with some very key high-level news information. We'll go for a new colour scheme. Hopefully you'll find it a little bit more relaxing. It won't be the yellow and purple. We've taken the colours from the app, App Aber, and so we're hopefully going for a more calming, relaxing colour scheme. And the big thing is the customisable My Modules box. You'll be able to sort by semester or by title. You'll be able to colour code by role, so if you've got a lot of modules that you're an instructor on and you want to highlight those, you'll be able to do that. You will be able to choose how that module ID appears. So some people said they wanted it, some people didn't. Some people need to be able to differentiate between Mauritius or New College Cambria modules, so those will be, that will be by preference. And you'll be able to group by semester. So if it's easier to search by semester, you'll be able to group by semester. We've got a lot more icons. It's much more simple. It's fewer clicks, and you should get there and find everything that you need. So that will be coming soon. So don't be alarmed if you log into Blackboard and find it's different. The front page, again, a lot simpler. It will just be a big, nice, relaxing picture of Aberystwyth with a login box on top of it. So hopefully, what we're hoping to do is encourage staff and students to send pictures so that we can use pictures from our community as well. So that's what Blackboard will look like. Hopefully you will find it more useful. Hopefully you will find it easier to use. And we will be collecting feedback during the year. So if something isn't working or if something's really good and you really like it, there will be an opportunity for you to let us know, we will obviously be developing. So, it's coming.
Have you made any improvements to the way content can be edited? Because for me, that's the single most annoying thing about Blackboard.
There is a new version. We've just upgraded, so you probably noticed there is a newer version that's just come out, which will have drag and drop content. There are some new features around content sharing, which I'm happy to chat with you about and show you those as well. So have a look at the new install. It only came live on Friday. Have a look at that, see what if it does what you want it to do. And if not, we can have a chat with you about that. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so without further ado,
so now I would like to ask you all to join me in welcoming our first keynote speaker for the conference. It's Dr. Rachel Ann Knight. She's the Associate Dean for Education Technology and Innovation and Associate Professor of Phonetics at City University of London. What excited us and why we were excited to invite you is your dynamic approach to interactive teaching and not something that's not just lecturing at people, but getting students engaged in learning. So please give a warm welcome to Rachel.
Hi folks, let me just sort out the microphone, I'll be right with you. How's that? Can you hear me okay at the back?
Just turn it so that we'll bring the lights down a little bit in the front.
All right.
So that your PowerPoint will show better.
Wonderful, how's that? So hopefully you can see me and hear me now? Wonderful. Okay, so thank you so much for having me here today. I was just telling some of you earlier, I think it's more than 20 years since I was in this part of the world when I was doing Outward Bound down the road at Abergavenny, so it's absolutely wonderful to be back and to see all your lovely facilities and everything that you've got going on at Aberystwyth, so thank you so much. So I'm going to talk today about interactive technology and teaching excellence. And I'm doing this really from two perspectives. So one is my Associate Dean Education role, where I have strategic responsibility for all of our teaching and learning in health sciences at City University of London. So that's nursing, midwifery, radiography, speech and language therapy, optometry. So quite a big array of disciplines that come under my remit. But also from my own teaching as Associate Professor of Phonetics. So here I'm teaching phonetics, so the science of speech, to speech and language therapy students. And I want to talk to you today about some of the interactive technologies that I use with those students. So these are some of the things that we'll do. So I want to talk about the traditional lecture, what I mean by it, and what some of the problems might be. And then contrast that with active learning, thinking about some of the ways we might encourage students to be actively engaged in our teaching, particularly by using some interactive technologies. And I'll spend a bit of time there showing you some examples. So if you've got some devices with you, and I see some of you have, then in about 15, 20 minutes, we'll have an opportunity to try some of those interactive technologies. But I'll tell you how to do that when we get there. From there, I'll think about how this all relates to teaching excellence, both in terms of the teaching excellence framework and teaching excellence more generally. And if we've got time at the end, I'll also think about how we can embed these interactive technologies, so both in our own teaching, but also more widely. So if you're thinking about doing this in your division, in your faculty or school, in the institution, or maybe even across the whole sector. So to start then, what do I mean by the traditional lecture? Well, it's basically what I'm doing now. It's someone standing at the front and telling you stuff with students or audience members sitting there and listening. So this is a picture that I've stolen from Wikipedia that you see over here on the right. I quite like it. It's from Bologna in the mid-14th century. And you see, if we look just here, we've got a lecturer standing at the front. It looks like he's reading from his lectern. We've got some students down here. Some of them are quite interested, like this little guy here. Others of them seem to be asleep. Others of them look like they'd rather be absolutely anywhere else. And it might be a reflection of some of the things we see when we stand up and we just talk at students. Nevertheless, there's evidence that this traditional lecture format is one of the most prevalent forms of teaching in higher education across the world. So it's not particular to any institution, any particular country. It's just really common. And it's this kind of transmissive approach. So the idea being that the lecturer communicates what's in their brain to the students in a kind of oral medium. Student listens, the student takes notes, and perhaps they go away and read those later on. As you probably know, there's been quite a lot of criticism of the traditional lecture. So I could have picked a whole variety of things to illustrate this. But there's quite a nice review paper by Phillips in 2005 where he reviews some of that literature. And I've given you two quotes from the paper here. So the first one of these is by Bly, which is a book from the 1970s, which you might know about. And basically the whole of that book talks about what the alternatives to lecturing might be, why the traditional lecture might not be such a good idea.
And the quote here says that, yeah, you can use a lecture to teach information and the framework of the subject, but that kind of transmissive expository approach isn't suitable if you want to stimulate thought or if you want to change the attitudes in your students. Lorillard, more recently in 2002, goes further really by saying that the only reason we do lectures in this traditional way is because they're legitimised by 800 years of tradition. And it's not just the academic literature that has some criticisms. There's quite regularly criticisms of the traditional lecture in the popular press as well. So this one that you see here on the right is from the BBC website in November of last year. And it's asking the question, shouldn't lectures be obsolete by now? Because both of the evidence for how students learn and also the different ways of teaching that might be afforded to us by technology. So we've thought a little bit about general criticisms of the traditional lecture, and quite often set against this is the idea of active learning, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. There's quite a few different definitions of active learning. The one I've given you here is from Prince in 2004, and this is a quote that you see on the left. So it's generally defined as any instructional method, and I think this is quite important, so it's not just one thing, it's a whole range of different methods, which engage students in the learning process. So we come back to that word of engagement. And then there's these two key components at the bottom of the quote. So active learning requires students to do meaningful learning activities. So it kind of makes sense. It's active learning, it requires students to be active and do activities. But also to think about what they're doing. And quite often when we look at definitions of active learning, this idea of thinking about that your own learning or reflecting on your learning is equally as important as the activities that students are doing. Active learning comes, as I've already said, in a variety of different forms. So if you have a look at the table on the right, this is taken from a paper by Michael in 2006. There's a list here of all the different things that active learning can be. And these are probably things that you're already using in your teaching. So anything that's problem-based or case-based, anything that's collaborative or involves peer instruction, things that are inquiry or discovery-based, and technology-enhanced learning. So all of these things can lend themselves to these active learning scenarios where students are engaged and where they're encouraged to reflect. So what about the evidence for active learning? Why would we say that it's better than the standard traditional lecture? Part of this evidence relates to progression. I should just say at this point, you'll see there's a big SR up on my slides. This is to remind me to thank my colleague Stian Reimers, who I'll mention a little bit later. Stian has let me borrow a couple of his slides from a presentation. So where you see the SR, that's me saying a big thanks to Stian for this. So this particular paper you might have come across, it's received quite a lot of press attention as well as attention in the academic literature. This was Freeman et al. In 2014, and it's a meta-analysis, so it collects together a very large number of studies that have looked at active learning and passive learning. And really the headline news from this paper is that if we're looking at progression, if we're looking at where the students pass or fail and progress into the next part of their course, passive traditional lectures, the thing that I'm doing now, lead to higher failure rates than active learning. So I've taken a couple of the diagrams from that paper here. If you look at the one labelled B on the right first, what we see here are some density plots. So the blue mountain is the active learning scenarios, a variety of different types of active learning, but all active learning. The orange mountain is the traditional lecture transmissive format. And the peaks of those curves are marked by the dotted lines that you see here. Along the bottom, we have the percentage of students who fail any particular class in relation to these methods. And if we look at the peak of this curve here, this is the traditional lecture format, where about 35% of students fail. And if we compare that to the active learning format, we see that that comes down quite a long way to just over 20%. And that's shown in a similar way in this diagram here on the left, where basically you've got just over 10% fewer students failing their courses if they're taught using these active learning methods. So obviously we don't just want our students to progress, we want them to do well as well. So as well as passing, we want them to get good marks. This is a paper by Vyman and Gilbert in 2015. And it's not a meta-analysis, but they do collect quite a number of different studies together. And I've taken a quote from the paper here, which you see on the left. Their key message is that to develop expertise, so to be good at a subject, to get a high level of attainment, this requires students to do intense practice. That intense practice means doing challenging and relevant tasks, followed by feedback and reflection on performance. So if you compare that to the active learning quote that we saw earlier, you'll see that they're quite similar. This is one of the figures from that paper. So this time we've got test score along the horizontal axis. So low scores of 1 being at the left, high scores of 12 being at the right. The particular test that's being shown here, the score that you would get by guessing is 3. So if you don't know anything at all and you just guess, you'd be expected to get a 3. These dark purple bars here are students taught using a standard transmissive lecture approach. The lilac coloured bars here are students taught in what's called an experimental condition, but this was essentially different sorts of active learning. And as you can see, students who get the higher scores tend to have been taught in that experimental active learning condition, whereas the students who have the lower scores tend to have been taught in the transmissive standard lecture format. So we see evidence there that active learning helps students to pass their courses, and it also helps them to do better in terms of the marks that they get in tests. So we might ask, why then do traditional lectures prevail? Why do we, as a sector, keep on doing transmissive lectures if the evidence for them isn't really there? Gough and Cowper did a survey of economics instructors. And first of all, they confirmed that what we think is true, that most teaching is this transmissive traditional lecture format. So for the median respondents, 70% of their time in classrooms was in a lecture format. And that's the median, so there were some lecturers who were spending almost all their time doing transmissive lecturing. The second part of this study was to look at why that happens. And basically, traditional lectures were seen as being preferred, so being better for students, and having substantial advantages. So about a third of the lecturers who were questioned thought that students learnt best from being lectured. About 28% thought that although they knew students didn't really learn best, this was the most cost-effective way to deliver education. And about 40% believed that students didn't learn best and therefore alternatives were preferred. But you've still got this very large number of staff who either think students do learn best or know that they don't, but think this is the most cost-effective way to do it. And I think this really correlates with some of the things that I hear when I talk to people at my institution and across the sector about why do people like to give lectures? Why do people carry on doing this despite the evidence that says it's maybe not the best thing for our students? One of these is about increasing sizes of the number of people we've got in front of us in a room. So I often talk to people who used to have 50 students and now they've got 200, rooms even bigger than that, maybe up to 500 or 600 students. And that massification of higher education can make it feel very difficult to do anything that's active or interactive with students. There's also sometimes a sense that, you know, this is what students are here for. So if you've got an expert in front of you, why wouldn't you want to hear what's in their head and what they've got to say? Lecturers also talk about having a degree of control over the subject matter. So a slight unease that if you go too far down the active learning route, students might not cover the material that you want them to cover. They might not get to the end of the things that you'd hoped that you would get through on that day. And sometimes it's a lack of awareness of the type of alternatives that there might be. There's also an issue in terms of workload and time. So if something seems to be working quite well, then of course you might think, well, why would I spend time doing something different? And that might also be based on our own learning experiences. So oftentimes we think that if we were taught in a transmissive fashion, and we did okay, then actually that will work as well for our students. I've also read, no one's actually told me this, but I read this in a blog post a couple of weeks ago, that the lecture some people see as being a good way to teach concentration. So the idea being that nowhere else will a student ever sit for an hour or for 2 hours and have to maintain their concentration. So it's almost like an exercise in mindfulness, if you like, that you pay attention, you listen to the argument, so you're not on your device for that hour or those 2 hours. I think that's quite an interesting, way of thinking about things. And then also often our institutional quality and governance processes will count teaching hours. They will be counted in a workload approach, and people might be reluctant to do anything that takes something away from their face-to-face learning hours. Those are my experiences from talking to my colleagues. Marshall has very similar information coming out of the paper in 2009, but I just wanted to skip to these bottom two here. So one is about credibility. So one of the reasons we might not adopt new approaches is that we're sceptical about their efficacy. So do they really work? Particularly if we're going to abandon this system again next year. So it might all be very well and good to try the newest technology, but if it's not going to do anything for us and next year we can't renew the licences or everyone's got a new style of mobile phone and it won't work, then why would we do this? And then even more broadly than that is the issue of time and incentives. So I'm very interested in how academics progress, particularly when they're on education-focused contracts or when most of their work is in education. And this is by no means true everywhere, but there is that sense in the sector that it's good research that gets you promoted. Good teaching might even be suspect. So the idea that if someone's spending time on their teaching, it possibly means they're not a very good researcher. And that means if you have that kind of culture, and I'm by no means suggesting you do here, but if you do have that type of culture, it means that there isn't an incentive to spend time on excellent teaching. So what we've got then is evidence that most teaching is in a traditional lecture format across the higher education world, but evidence that students don't learn so well from that type of teaching. They learn much better from something that's active. And evidence that lecturers might find it challenging to change away from that transmissive style. So what do we do? How can we introduce active learning with a minimum of disruption? And I have three things to say about this. The first is, I think we have to accept the realities of the situation. So all of those things we talked about, they're real. The time it takes to prepare things, increasing sizes of classes, the possible lack of incentives for concentrating on teaching. They're real things, so we can't pretend they don't exist. That means we need to provide solutions which are easy to use and which can be supported institutionally, hopefully by building up a community of practice so that staff can support one another. And of course, we've got this wealth of evidence about learning in higher education, so we need to work with that so that what we're doing is evidence-based and led by pedagogical concerns rather than being simply led by the latest, newest technology. So one way I think we can do this, one way I think that we can make it easy for staff to involve in something active, even when they're time poor and have lots of students in front of them, is by using some interactive classroom technologies. So polling or personal response systems have been popular for a number of years. I think you have, is it Quizdom here at Aberystwyth? So I think you have Quizdom. So originally the polling technologies used these bespoke handsets, which you have to give out at the beginning of the class and then take them back in again at the end. There's some newer systems now which allow students to use their own devices, and they tend to work whether the student's got a laptop or a tablet or the mobile phone, they tend to work equally well. And there's lots of different systems out there, but they've got broadly similar features. So my personal experience is, first of all, with using Notec, so I still quite like to do active learning with flip charts and post-it notes and stickers and things. I've also used clickers for quite a long time. I now use Poll Everywhere, which I'll talk to you about in a minute, and there's a couple of other alternatives, so Kahoot and Twitter, which I'll talk about a bit more at the end. I'm going to focus particularly on Poll Everywhere because it's the system that I know the most. And my plan is, in a minute, you don't have to do anything yet, is to show you some of the types of questions that we might use with our students, but also some of the ways in which we can use them. So what are we using them for, as well as the types of questions that we might use. So are you ready for a bit of interaction, Ben, as I've been talking at you for 19 minutes, which is probably just about the upper boundary of where you want me to talk at you for. Okay, so at the moment nothing's happening. All you've got here is a screenshot of what I'm going to ask you to do in a minute. If you have a device with you and you don't mind using it today, what I'd like you to do is to go to the URL that you can see here, which I hope is visible at the back. So it's pollev, pollev.com. Then there's a forward slash, and you've got a form of my name, so Knight, like my surname, Knight, RA. And at the moment, you're probably not going to see very much, but if you can just try and go to that URL, I think your Eduroam is working, so hopefully we'll be okay. What you're seeing on the screen now is my version, so this is the live version. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to push this out to you, and I'm going to unhide the responses. So for those of you who are in, can you see that question on your devices? Yeah? So what I'm going to ask you to do is just tell me your first name. So this can be a pseudonym, it can be your initials, it can be your pet's name, it can be anything you fancy, but just something that you'd like to see come up on the screen. Welcome everybody, it's nice to see you. And also good to know at this point that it's working. So there's a couple of reasons that we might want to use this with our students. One is the very simple fact of making sure their devices are working. So you don't want to wait until the sort of high stakes multiple choice question before you figure out that they can't get on the Wi-Fi or whatever. The other is, do you notice how much students like it when you know their names? They really like it, don't they? And what the evidence shows us is that our students like to be treated as individuals. Of course they do, just like everything else that we do in life. They like it when their lecturers know them as individuals, when they know their names. So I can make this a little bigger for you if you'd like to see it. There you all are. So one of the ways that I like to use this is really by breaking the ice. So I would usually use a who's here question very early on in the session. Partly I can work out how many students I've got, but also I can once I start to learn student names, I can chat to them. So I don't know any of you guys, unfortunately, but if I did, I could say, hello Neil, hello Thomas, hello whoever, and I can demonstrate to students that I'm taking notice of them as individuals. So, let's try another one. So what we have here is a survey question. So I'm asking you, have you used audience response systems before? You can see that at the moment I've left I've left it on so that you can see what the responses are. So what you'll see is as people respond, we can see the changing demographics. The reason I might use this with students is to ask them, for example, something like how confident they're feeling before a test. So I could give them options of very confident, not at all confident, somewhere in the middle. And because this is anonymous, I haven't asked any of you to give me your emails or your login details or anything. Students can tell you that without feeling exposed. So they tend to feel more comfortable than they might be if you ask students to raise their hand to tell you something quite personal, like, I'm feeling really anxious before this test that you've got coming up. So this is also useful information for me in that about half of you have used these audience response systems a little bit. A few of you I'm featuring to the converted because you've used them a lot, and some of you haven't used them at all. So now what we have, and I'm going to stop. You should still be able to respond, but you won't be able to see the responses. So this is a good old multiple choice question, and it relies on just some of the talking that I was doing earlier. So it doesn't matter whether you know or not, really, but which study showed fewer fails for students engaged in active learning? One of these is the right answer. So what's happening now is, behind the scenes, your results are coming in. And if you look down here, you can see that I can see about how many of you have responded. But because this is a question with a right answer, you can't be distracted by other people's responses. Obviously, people take different amounts of processing time, and sometimes what students find is that if everyone else's response has gone up there before they've had time to think about it, they never really work out whether they knew the answer or not. So I've got about 34 of you. I reckon that might be where we stop. So I can do two things. I can show you the responses. And normally at this point people start to change their mind. So normally people start adding themselves to the one that's looking like the better option. What I can also do is I can show you the correct answer, which 76% of you got right. And so this is really useful if you're using something like lecture capture, Echo, Panopto, whatever it is you might use. All of that gets captured on your lecture capture slides as well, so the students can automatically see what the right answer is. Okay, so this is a different sort of activity. What I'd like you to do now, and I won't tell you too much about it, you can see what comes up. Just use one word to describe these type of interactive polling activities. And don't be worried about offending me. So it doesn't matter if you think that they're not very exciting or not very interesting, that's fine, put that in. So just one word to describe what you think. Can you see it, by the way? Not come up? This is the one I have the most problems with, so let's just try and push it out to you again. Is it there now? Sometimes needs just a double click, this one. So what we're ending up with is a word cloud. So I'm sure you've seen things like Wordle and things like that. So we're basically getting a Wordle, which will do exactly what Wordle does, and the words that come more often will be bigger, and the words that come less often will be smaller. And you can save all these, so if later on I want to take this and turn it into something, I can screenshot it and take it out and put it somewhere else. And it's slightly hypnotic as well, so I won't stand there and stare at it for too long, but it is a rather beautiful thing that we see in front of us. This is quite nice if you've got something that's a little bit more subjective for students. So for me, most of my sessions are quite technical, but I do have sessions where we have to talk about things like the sort of social pressures around having a particular sort of accent, or the social pressures around changing your accent to go for a job interview, things like that. These type of activities can be quite useful to gain some of those subjective opinions from students. Again, we've got that anonymity, but we've also got the ability to kind of combine the different responses that we get, so more than just having a kind of scattered array of opinions. It's still going, it's lovely. Okay, so I'll move on from that one. So hopefully what you can see on this one is here we've got a variety of correct answers. So I'm asking you here, what do you think students like best about interactive polling technologies? These are all things that students like. But hopefully what you can see is that you can put them in the order that you'd like them to be in, so you can rank them. Is that what it looks like for you? Are you able to drag them up and down? No? Not able to drag? So you're just getting to vote? Can you drag? Yeah. So you should be able to, with these, you should see all four of those options, and you should be able to drag the one that you think they like best up to the top, and the one that you think that they like least down to the bottom. So you can probably think of a variety of different ways that you might use this. I use it in a couple of different ways. So one might be before we do a test, I might ask students which section of that test they want to revise, and then it's not just those with the loudest voices who get their opinion heard, but all of our students get to vote. I also do it for ear training, so in phonetics I make noises from all the languages in the world and students have to tell me what they are. Sometimes we just want a right answer, but sometimes I might want, you know, of these options, which one do you think it was most likely to be? So it's kind of like an intermediate step. And this, if you are a symbol person, if you do phonetics, if you do engineering, if you do maths, it also works very well with symbols as well, so you can usually get them to show up. And finally, we've got some visual questions. So this is a how are you feeling today question. And of course, there's no right answer. You might be feeling in any. I hope no one's down in the red, but you might be. So what you can see is that you can respond here just by pressing on the visual. This is really useful for example, I teach little bits and pieces of biology and anatomy. So I might have a head diagram and I might say, show me where the velum is, show me where the alveolar ridge is. Or I might, my colleagues sometimes use it for radiography or for nursing, for anatomy. I have colleagues who use it for geography. Of course, there are no right answers here, but if this was the type of question with a right answer, I could also reveal it just like I did in the multiple choice question. So I'm glad to see most of you up that end of the spectrum, and I hope some of the people who are in the red manage to come up a little bit more after the end of today. So, these are the ones that we just looked at. Oops. Okay. So how did you like it? Did you like a bit of interaction?
Yes.
Yes? So the students like it too. So in module evaluations, the interactive things tend to be the things that the students like best, as I'm sure you've experienced in your own teaching. This was particularly to ask students whether or not they found that particular format, the Poll Everywhere format, helped their learning. I asked them, if it does, then tell me how it helps, and if it doesn't, then tell me why not. This isn't all of the responses, but just the ones I thought that you'd be able to see from the back. The rest are pretty much in the same vein. So you'll see here most students say yes. They say that it's engaging, it keeps them interested, it helps them to work out how they're progressing. They also start to reflect on their learning. So they say things like, I work best by doing examples, and yes, I'm able to practice. So if you think about all those active learning quotes we looked at, students are saying the same thing. They're liking the bits of it that relate back to active learning. Some students, the thing I mentioned to you before about students find it distracting when they can see the responses coming in. A couple of students reminded me about that here, so that's just a reminder to me that if there is a correct answer, to always hide it until most of the responses have come in. And then my favourite is this one here, where a student says she loves it, it engages her in the lecture, she wished she could use Poll Everywhere all the time, even when she was at home. And actually you could sit at home and still do the Poll Everywhere questions if you came on at the right time. So then, we talked a bit about the benefits of active learning generally, but what about this kind of quizzing that you're allowed to do in systems like this? So I must say the type of way that I use those techniques most often is to do multiple choice questions that do have a right answer. I use the other techniques as well, but that's probably the way that I use it most. I might do that at the beginning of a lecture to recap on reading or the previous week. I might do it during the lecture, so after tiny little chunks of lecturing, and I might do it at the end to recap on learning goals and activities. So this paper by Dunlosky et al. In 2013 looked at the variety of ways that students learn things. So it's largely about the memory side of learning. And you can see a bit of the paper that I've taken here. They looked at lots of things that students tell us that they do to help themselves. So they might summarise blocks of text. They might highlight in their notes. They might use keywords, or they might use imagery. Well, according to this paper, all of those techniques are of really low utility. They don't really help students to remember things. The two things that have high utility are practice testing, so very much like the multiple choice questions that we were just talking about, especially when that's done in a distributed fashion. So not just that I test you now and then I never ask you about it again, but that maybe we test you on something similar next week or 2 weeks down the line or again at the end of the lecture. So not just practice testing, but practice testing in a distributed fashion. And I think this is where these particular interactive techniques really come into their own. There are some other options. So the one that I've shown you is Poll Everywhere. Here are three others that I'm familiar with, just in case you're interested in looking at them a bit further. So has anyone seen Kahoot? Some people come across Kahoot. How do you like it?
I
You can shout at me. You like Kahoot?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's kind of different, isn't it, to the Poll Everywhere stuff. So you can see a screenshot of it here. So it's kind of colourful. The student will click on a shape which corresponds to the answer that they like, that they see up on the lecturer's slides. It usually has some music. You can put images and things in the background. And I guess the big thing about it is that it's got an aspect of gamification in there. So students put their a pseudonym or their name in at the beginning of the quiz, and then you get a leaderboard after each question, which tells you how well you're doing. Some students like that competitive aspect, some students don't, so it depends a bit on what your cohort is like. But as you say, it's colourful, it's multimedia, and it's a bit more of a gamified approach. My colleague, Stian, who I mentioned before, is working on Quodl. So this is a new system that we're working at in my university. Quodl is also designed to be gamified, but maybe with a little bit less, maybe with a little bit of a more grown-up feel than we've got in Kahoot. And there's also Twitter. Has anyone done Twitter polls? I could be doing a Twitter poll to ask you if anyone's done a Twitter poll, but I'm not. So we've got a couple of people who've done Twitter polls. So if you're interested in Twitter, Twitter allows you to send a tweet that is a poll, so people can choose which response that they would like. And I use this to try and get my students interested in Twitter. So in our final year dissertations, one of the things we'd like students to do is be talking to people who are working in a similar field to them, including maybe, you know, the world-renowned experts who are working in that particular area. That's pretty hard to do face-to-face at a conference, but it might not be so difficult to do if you use the same hashtag as them on Twitter or if you follow them and they follow you back. And one of the ways that we do that is by doing some Twitter polls early on, which encourage students to sign up for Twitter, and then hopefully they can go on and use those other functions. So then, some comparisons to a non-technical solution. So I've shown you Poll Everywhere. I've suggested a whole a number of other types of system that you might use. But as I mentioned to you before, I still sometimes do use the non-technical way. I use post-its, I use stickers, I use marker pens. So what are the disadvantages of these technical solutions? Obviously, they require a device. Most students have one, but not all students want to use it for taking part in learning. So that means we might need to let students share, or we might need to have some kind of system in the institution where students can borrow for short amounts of time. It requires data and it requires Wi-Fi, and of course these things go down sometimes, it's just the nature of the world, in which case you can't use it. It's a little bit of a learning curve. Normally what I experience is exactly what we experienced here, that in general people can get up and running on their device fairly quickly, within a few minutes, within the first lecture. But of course it's also a bit of a learning curve for the lecturer setting them up as well. And there is some setup required. There are some restrictions in the question type and in the response format. I must say, personally, I've not found anything that I'd like to do that I can't do using these systems, but I imagine there probably is something out there that actually can't be replicated. I must say, though, putting all of those things aside, I think the advantages outweigh them. So for me, the huge advantage is that we get instant feedback. So the students get feedback about how they're doing, whether they got the right answer, but also how they're doing in relation to the rest of the group. And we as lecturers get instant feedback on how well our students are getting the things that we're talking about. And so that might mean that you segue into a whole different kind of discussion, but it does mean that you know instantly how the students are doing. I think a real advantage is that these systems can be anonymous. So certainly what my students tell me is that they don't feel exposed, that they feel really quite happy to make their selections much happier than they'd feel than just by raising their hand, for example. And although the one I showed you was anonymous, you can also have students register and track their progress. And some work we're doing at City at the moment, we're trying to see if we can use that to identify students who are struggling early on. Obviously, progression is on a lot of people's agenda, and it would be nice to know if students were having difficulty with material before they get to the summative assessment. Also, these are really easily reusable. So if I haven't changed anything, when I come to do the same lecture next year, I can just clear off the responses and start again. But also I can flexibly create questions right here and now. So with my first years, just before Christmas, we usually write some Poll Everywhere questions, and I can knock them up and put them together in the break. So they're really easy and quick to put questions together. So I'll probably just talk for about another 10 minutes and then give you an opportunity to ask me some questions. I just wanted to talk about how this type of interactive learning might fit with good practice guidelines. So this is a table from the Wonky blog, which has three of the different types of good practice guidelines. The seven principles of good practice in undergrad education I'm sure you're familiar with. And if we think about active learning and prompt feedback and student time on task, these are all things that these interactive solutions might allow us to do more easily. Likewise, John Biggs's characteristics of effective teaching, they talk about relevant learner activity, they talk about formative feedback. And certainly something I see with my students is that it really helps to build student motivation when they're doing this regular distributed testing. And then we have the Wabash National Study, which again talks about prompt feedback and interactional diversity. So I think there's lots of boxes in terms of the good practice guidelines that can be ticked by using these kinds of solutions. And I promised a little bit about teaching excellence as well, because we're living in a TEF world and you can't really stand up and not talk about the TEF. Obviously, then, we've got this focus on teaching excellence. So as you know, in 2006, the UK PSF, the UK Professional Standards Framework, was published by the HEA. And lots of the activities and knowledge and values that are contained in that framework touch on things like interactive learning, using technology in order to support our students. And then we've got the teaching excellence framework documentation, which talks about placing a spotlight on teaching, encouraging excellent teaching, helping institutions improve their teaching, before saying that teaching excellence matters and that they wanted it to flourish across the sector. Now, quite how excellent teaching fits with the TEF, I think, is a matter of debate. I'm by no means the first person to say that we're all behind the idea that we want the best quality education for our students, but quite whether the TEF measures that or not, I think, is up for debate. So as you probably know, the Teaching Excellence Framework has metrics. They relate to progression, employability, and student satisfaction. I think we can see how these interactive learning techniques might support progression. We saw data on that from the Freeman paper towards the beginning of the talk, particularly if we can use them to try and identify students early on who might be struggling and might need some extra support. I think it's harder to see how these techniques might support employability, but I guess it depends what your questions are. So if you have interactive teaching and learning around employability skills, maybe interview skills, communication skills, then you could possibly make the argument that they would support employability. And this is a hunch. I don't think there's any work on it, but my sense is that interactive learning will support student satisfaction as well, that students will feel that they are getting more for what they put into higher education, be that financially or otherwise. So I think it might be a bit of a stretch, but I think we can see that there is some relationship between the kind of interactive learning that we might do and with these metrics that come up in the Teaching Excellence Framework. Nevertheless, that's probably not all there is to teaching excellence. But it's ever so difficult to define. So I'm sure you've seen the literature around this. Teaching excellence is called a contested topic. The idea being that we don't really know what we're looking for. No one's quite defined it yet. There's a huge literature on this. I've just given you some quotes here from Gunn and Fisk, largely because they provide three provisional definitions about teaching excellence. And these are quite useful distinctions. So the first is about teacher excellence. This is conceptions of excellence that are related to the individual, the one individual teacher. Then we have teaching excellence, and this is about things more than that individual. So the educational system more generally, maybe things around assessment, maybe things around curriculum design, maybe things around timetabling. And then we have excellent learning. So this relates to the learning that the student achieves. And so here we have three kind of provisional definitions of what teaching excellence might be. There's also evidence, though, that students in different disciplines think that different things are teaching excellence. And if you teach across a variety of disciplines, you might have seen that, and that students want quite different things from their lecturing environment. So I was just going to tell you very briefly about a study we did which tried to pin down what teaching excellence means in the health sciences. And this is part of a bigger study looking at both lecturers and students across disciplines. So this is a study that was run by my undergrad dissertation students, Tanya and Yael, last year, in collaboration with Professor Pam Parker, who some of you might know. And what we were trying to do is work out what are the behaviours and what are the concepts of teaching excellence. So what does teaching excellence mean as a concept? And what are the behaviours of an excellent teacher? What do they look like? So because I've been talking for a while again, and we know we want some activity going on, just for now, no polls for you to do just at the minute, but have a go at just writing the answers to these two questions. I've said individually, but I actually don't mind if you chat. So one is the concepts question. What does teaching excellence mean to you? Two is the behaviours question. So I'd like you to put yourself back in the shoes of when you were a student for this one. So there is an equivalent lecturer version, but I don't have the data to show you for that for the moment. So think back to when you were a student. Think about your really excellent teacher or teachers, and think about the behaviours that they used. So if you just write them down for now, and then I've got a different sort of poll to show you. So what you'll see here, I'll push this out to you. Can you see that question on your devices, folks? Nod, shake, yeah, lovely, thank you. So now what should happen, and again, this is one of the newer polls, it doesn't always work, so we're being a little experimental. If you use quite short responses, this is the concepts question, what does teaching excellence mean to you? When a response appears, we should see it here. And if you like it, you can sort of plus one that one. You can vote it up. If you don't like it, you can vote it down. So these type of polls are quite useful when there's an array of right answers, but you'd also like to reach some group consistency. So hopefully you can see all of these on your screens now, and you can vote them up and down rather than putting the same one in twice. So I'll just give you a minute or two to do that. So we've got good communication coming out towards the top, as well as dynamism, inspiring our students to learn. Okay, so what seems to be coming out on the top are inspiring students to study, good communication, encouraging independent learning, empathy, engaging students. So you can keep on voting those up and down if you want. I'll just flick back to the slides. Just in the interest of time, I actually won't do the poll for the second one, but I will just show you some of the results that we got. So for concepts, these were thematically analysed and students grouped them together. I think the biggest two that I'd just like to talk about, the things that students really value are teaching style and skills, so the manner of teaching, the strategies and the materials, but also the relationship, so the interaction between the student and the teacher and their students, and between the group as a whole, actually. And I think I'd go so far as to say that the kind of interactive teaching and technologies that we've talked about today allow us to do both of those things. It allows us to be quite innovative in our materials and the way we present. But depending on what we do with that interactive teaching, it also allows us to build that relationship with our students by having a dialogue around the answers that they've given. And the results for behaviours are quite similar. So we talked earlier about how part of the resistance to trying something new is sometimes about it, that it might be gimmicky. It might not be around for much longer, it might not be here to stay. I think that's not the case for these kind of interactive technologies. The NMC Horizon report, which as you probably know looks at trends in higher education involving technology, in the 2017 version, it talked about mobile learning and suggested that the time to widespread adoption was 1 year or less. It specifically references the type of in-class quizzing that we've been talking about today as something that can be highly useful and successful for students. It notes that 2/3 of students are already using their mobile devices to study, and that that's likely to increase. And it's quite a good read. It's quite short, but it also recommends a variety of resources for integrating mobile learning into your teaching. And it suggests the SAMR model, which you probably already know about, where you think about whether what you're doing with technology substitutes or augments or modifies, or in fact even allows you to completely redefine something that you've been doing without technology. And my last point to say is just that obviously these things take time to get off the ground. So you're probably familiar with the bell curve by Rogers in 1962. So what we have along here is time scale of adoption. What we have up here is the percentage of people who might have adopted a particular innovation. So at the beginning, we have this very small group of innovators. So these might be the people who built these apps that allow you to do interactive polling. And then after a bit more time, we might have the early adopters, so the people who are very enthusiastic about a technology. You know, these are the people who've always got the newest iPhone and things like that. And then we've got this kind of chasm. And what's interesting if we want a technology to take off is how we get it over that tipping point, how we get the early and the late majority to get involved with that particular technology. And one of the ways it's suggested that this happens is that those adopter categories have very different characteristics. So if you guys are the early adopters, then you might like radical change, you might be visionary, you might be risk takers and willing to experiment and quite happy to look after yourself, after yourselves. But in order for colleagues in the mainstream to take this on, there's a variety of things that those colleagues will need. So in particular, they need proven users. So for those of you who are using mobile technologies, take those things that you're doing and take the evidence that you've got from them and treat them as case studies so that your colleagues can see how well they work, so they can see what the uses are for these particular technologies. And we need to provide support. So not everyone will be willing to take a new technology and run with it on their own, even if they've seen what the proven use is. They will need institutional support, they'll need community of practice, and they might just need the person on the next desk to say, yeah, absolutely, I'll give you a hand with that. So we've talked about the traditional lecture and why there maybe isn't such good evidence for its efficacy. We've contrasted that with active learning and talked about how it can support students to progress and to attain. We've thought about interactive technologies as a way that we can do active learning, but without taking huge amounts of time or huge amounts of preparation to do. We've related those things to good practice guidelines and teaching excellence. And just in the last 2 minutes, we've thought a little bit about how we might embed those interactive technologies that are probably here to stay. I think you've probably heard enough of me for now. You may give me poll everywhere questions, or if you want to ask me anything, you could just shout at me. That would be absolutely fine. I'm ready for your questions. Any questions, folks?
Some of the factors that influence us to continue using lectures.
Yeah.
And I think one of those factors is student expectation.
Okay, that's interesting.
Part of the reason I say that is because while I was observing a colleague teach, and she wasn't using interactive technologies, but she was using active learning. The students were engaged in discussion on various topics, and this was interspersed throughout the lecture.
Sounds lovely.
But when she called them back to attention to carry on speaking, there was a kind of palpable buzz in the room. So, oh, right, okay, this is what we're really looking for. And I think I saw that only because I happened to be observing her teaching. And it just struck me as quite interesting. And I think there is often, there may be a resistance for some students because they think we are university students. This is what we do.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if that's the case, then I think there's a lot of work to be done in educate
with our students as well
about what to expect and what our expectations are.
Yeah,
I think that's based on one brief observation, but it did strike me quite possibly.
No, I hear you absolutely. I think we do see that with our students, and it does take time. So I'm quite lucky with my students; I get them from day one, and we can sort of have that conversation. I think part of it is about saying, there's a reason that we're doing this, and there is evidence that your learning will be deeper. I also don't think it's a bad thing if students are a bit more engaged after an activity, even if it is for the next bit of lecturing. I think that's absolutely fine. But I agree with you, this shouldn't really just, like anything we do, it shouldn't just be something that we impose on our students. It should be a kind of conversation that says, we're hoping this is going to work really well for you. But it's a great point, thank you. Lady behind you.
I'm just going to say, I actually asked a group of students who hadn't experienced 2-hour interactive lectures before what they preferred, and they said they would prefer, please, their 2-hour lecture sessions to begin with the interactive stuff and then have a proper lecture. I think it is a case of educating the students into what to expect.
Yeah, we don't always know what's good for us, do we?
Yeah.
So we don't. So just because we prefer something doesn't necessarily mean that it's the best thing for our learning. And people learn differently as well. So not everyone will benefit quite as much from active learning as the next person.
They did give their reasons, but it was interesting to hear.
What were their reasons, incidentally?
Some of them found it difficult to switch on and switch off to the different methods they were being asked to think. Some of them with learning difficulties said it's more straightforward for them to have a block done one way than a block done another way. So, it's a case of educating them into why we do things as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. So exactly as I said before, not sort of imposing things on our students, but trying to get something that works for everybody, I think, is the way forward. There's all sorts of people. Gentlemen at the back.
I think there's a bit of problem with the questions just now. I think it's a little unfair for me to ask this, because I don't think you're necessarily actually wanting to abolish a proper lecture. All these things are kind of interspersed.
Yeah.
I think all that sort of media hype about the death of the tradition is actually a little bit overblown.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on what we are actually doing. I work in the English department, so we have very few facts to actually transmit to the students.
Sure.
And I always think, well, we should use our lectures to sort of model an approach to a specific topic. So we're giving them a practice run, or model of what they should be doing in their own time with their own learning and so on.
To be honest, I don't think the traditional lecture is going anywhere. But I suppose my point from this is that the evidence shows us that something that has some interactive elements built into it will be more beneficial for students. Doesn't mean it has to go out the window completely. Gentlemen in the purple.
To use these interactive techniques in lectures, and particularly where there's free-form input from students, you're really trusting those students to engage with it in a mature manner.
Yep.
And so how do you deal with the case where you've got a number of disruptive students, and possibly just one, who insists on doing things like submitting profanity or disruptive comments? Because we have actually found this to be a problem sometimes in reality.
So if you didn't hear the question, this was about students who might use these particular techniques to disrupt the room. So it might be swearing, it might be inappropriate comments coming up in your screen. The practical way is that you can set moderation on all of, in the ones that I was showing you, you can set moderation and delete the ones that you don't want before they show up on the screen, is the practical way. What I would say, though, again, is that is about knowing your student body, isn't it? And it's very difficult to do if you've got students who do want to disrupt. But I think in terms of educating the students about what you're trying to achieve, educating the students that this is about their learning, so it isn't really, although it might feel like a bit of fun, it's not really the time to be messing about. So probably a combination of those things where I'm sure your expectations are set very high for what you're expecting for students, but then also a technological way of blocking anything that you really don't want showing up on your screen. But I agree, once you go there, then you have always got that possibility.
We
time for one more quick question.
One more. Gentleman in the middle.
I was interested that you quoted Dunlosky, and that work and the people he's referencing basically says that learning is very, very difficult.
Absolutely.
And that students need to quiz themselves, that Peter Linton was an extremely large amount of work.
Yep.
And the problem that we often see is that students think that learning is very easy, that they should be able to remember every word that was said in the lecture. They don't recognise that they've forgotten an hour later. And they don't work routinely throughout the year, and their exam performance is dismal because it's based on last week. And you've shown that an intervention, technological intervention in the classroom, might lift your failure rate, reduce it 10%. Is there any evidence as to why that failure rate is reduced? Is it simply because of what's done in the classroom, or are you actually in some way changing the attitudes of the students outside?
So it's a really good question. I think what you're hoping is that it's both. So you're hoping that you're making the best of the classroom time, so students are taking something away and are being forced, if you like, to remember it a week later, 2 weeks later, if you keep doing the testing. But also, certainly what I see is that students are more inspired to do the learning. So what you're hoping to do is to model something and to have those explicit conversations with students that do say, you can't cram this, that you need to be keeping on practicing. So what the evidence would suggest is it's not just about what happens in the classroom, but it's also about the students' change in their perception of how they learn. But I have to chat with you about it afterwards. I think that's me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
For an inspiring talk, please join me. Thank you.
Before we break for tea, there'll be tea and refreshments, coffee in the think tank, but I'd like to present you with a small token.
Oh, that's lovely. Thank you very much.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
You
really
much.
Inspiring.
Thank you.
So we've got a half an hour tea break, so just make your way upstairs and help yourself. Okay, great. Thank you so much, John. Yeah.